All rise.
You may be seated. Our third case this morning is 2021-1163, Benita Stewart versus Solutions Community Counseling and Recovery Centers Incorporated et al. For the appellate, excuse me, Mr. Hanosky.
Yes, sir. Good morning, and may it please the court, Robert Hanosky for the defendants, appellates, Solutions, and their former employee, Jenny Epling. This case presents a very important issue, I would submit, to Ohio's mental health community. It presents a fairly narrow issue of first impression, specifically whether or not Ohio's mental health immunity statute, which was first enacted in 1999, applies to all acts of violence committed by mental health patients or just violent acts committed towards third parties. Implicit within that question and that issue is whether or not under the statute a mental health client can also be a victim. We would respectfully submit that the statute's plain language, based on the plain language of the statute and the ordinary meaning to be given to the language used, that the statute in fact applies to all acts of violence, those that are self-directed, including suicide or attempted suicide or just self-injurious behavior, as well as violence committed to others. And we would submit that to find otherwise would be contrary not only to the plain language of the statute, would be inconsistent with the intent of the statute, and would potentially, as Judge Piper indicated in his well-reasoned dissenting opinion below, potentially lead to absurd, inconsistent, unreasonable results based on various factual scenarios. Although this case has an extended procedural history, having been litigated extensively in federal court for years, having gone to the Sixth Circuit, the core facts relative to the issue before this panel are straightforward and not in dispute. Justin Stewart in 2016 was incarcerated in the Warren County Jail for approximately 3 months. He was in a single cell, which was locked, of course. During a shift change, committed suicide on August 30, 2016. My client, Solutions, at the time had a contract to provide fairly limited, discrete services at the jail. Essentially, they employed two counselors that were available for services, suicide checks, et cetera.
But before we get to that, why is this a final order?
It was, we are here in a refiled state action, correct, Justice DeWine? When this state action.
It's a denial of a motion to dismiss.
It was denial of a motion to dismiss.
It's not a final order.
It was, we would submit a denial of a substantial right. It was not a finding factually that we couldn't argue the mental health immunity statute. It was that the statute was a defense that we couldn't even utilize, couldn't argue even if the matter goes to trial.
That's remedial on appeal from a final order. I just don't see any scenario where we have a final order here.
Rule 54B language was given.
But you can put Rule 54B language in anything you want. It doesn't make it a final order.
It has been accepted by the 12th District. My opponent
district
never challenged
saying it's
that.
A final order doesn't make it a final order, nor does the trial court make it saying it's a final order.
We believe it would be akin to a denial of governmental immunity, and those cases.
Yeah, and of course, in those cases, there's a special statute that makes them immediately appealable. We don't have a special statute here that does that.
We would submit for purpose of this argument that it is final appealable. It was a denial of a substantial right. It was a denial of immunity, of the opportunity to even argue immunity to the extent the matter proceeded factually forward.
But there's no argument that you're standing in place of the government for political subdivision immunity. Wasn't alleged here, wasn't alleged below. So how do you now say you're standing in that footprint of the government in order for that provision to be triggered?
it's not an issue that's been addressed, obviously, before the 12th District or by my opponent. I believe that it is a final appealable order as a denial of a special right. There certainly are issues that can be immediately appealable, denial of privilege, denial of immunity, governmental immunity, of course.
Right. And in each of those cases, there's a statute that makes them immediately appealable.
Are you saying that the 2305 immunity, we should look at that similarly to the 2744 immunity?
I believe, based on the rulings below, that you should, because, it was a denial of our right to even argue the statute, to even argue the elements of the statute. It was a decision that the statute is wholly inapplicable to self-harm. That legal issue, obviously, is one of first impression. And the trial court thought it was immediately appealable, gave us 54B language. The 12th District thought it was immediately appealable. And we believe that it is as well.
So if it's not immediately appealable, where are we?
Presumably, if it's not, it would be remanded and the case would proceed. And under the current holdings of the trial court in the 12th District, it would presumably proceed under a common law theory without our ability to argue this statute as a defense.
And then you can appeal that. And you can appeal the whole argument that you're putting before us now.
If ultimately the judgment isn't in your favor.
If we lost,
well,
yes,
yeah,
of course.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Okay.
That is correct.
So there's an avenue for you and your client here, and probably a better avenue.
We believe that it's dispositive, and we believe it's dispositive because it has never been alleged and, in fact, has been judicially determined by the federal courts that have previously reviewed this case, that Justin Stewart's suicide was unforeseeable. We argued, actually, res judicata in our motion to dismiss, which wasn't argued or wasn't addressed by the trial court. It was deemed as a matter of law that his death was unforeseeable. Because of that, and because the plaintiff has never alleged or averred, either in the federal case or in this case or any briefing in this case, that there was ever any notice given to my clients by Justin Stewart or any other knowledgeable person under the statute, that there was an imminent and explicit risk that he was going to commit self-harm.
That's a defense, right?
It is. But I'm saying there's not even a fact that they have not. If the statute is applicable, the case is over, based on how it's pled and how it's been determined previously. Certainly for judicial economy purposes, I believe that this is the appropriate path to go, because I believe the statute is applicable. And if it is, the case is over. It would be over. If I can proceed on the analysis, the language we believe is clear. The title of the statute, immunity of mental health professional or organization as to violent behavior by client or patient. The statute was enacted to provide an avenue, although a narrow avenue, to establish civil liability against mental health professionals for violent behavior of clients. And again, whether self-directed or directed to others. The statute defines what a mental health client is, someone receiving services, defines what an organization is or a provider is providing services, defines what a knowledgeable person is, which is a family member or someone that knows the client and gives notice to the provider that there's a risk of harm. Doesn't define victim, doesn't define violent behavior. The common dictionary definitions of those terms would suggest that a victim is obviously you can be a victim of suicide. This court, on several prior occasions, has indicated that you can be a victim of suicide. We would submit Justin Stewart was a victim of suicide. He was also, as alleged, a mental health client. And to say that suicide is not an act of violent behavior, which is argued by the plaintiff, is inconsistent with common language and usage of the word. Certainly, it's violent behavior, in this case, hanging by a towel in a jail cell. There has been limited case law that's interpreted the statute. This court has done that on one occasion in the Campbell case, which held that the statute applies to an assault of a resident versus a resident in a facility. That's the only time this court has addressed it. I think it's only been cited 25 times or so by various courts. I have certainly raised it at trial proceedings on many occasions with regard to self-harm. This is the first issue on appeal. And of course, the 12th District, in a fairly sharply divided 2-1 decision, concluded that the statute only applies to violence committed towards third parties, rather than self-harm. We would hope and request that if this court accepts this case at this stage, that Judge Piper's dissenting opinion be adopted, his well-reasoned analysis be adopted, his analysis, which is consistent with our, obviously, briefing and analysis, that Justin Stewart not only was a mental health client, in this case, he was also the victim, and it's never been alleged at any point in time that there was any notice given to my clients that he was at risk for harm in any way. And the general intent of the statute, on the heels of the states of Morgan and prior to that Littleton, was to codify but limit the duty that is owed by a mental health provider both to the patient and to third parties with respect to violent behavior that's unforeseeable. It's well recognized that mental illness is often difficult to predict and address, and violent propensities that may come from that are very difficult to predict and forewarn and prevent. And the Ohio legislature, in enacting this statute, wanted to provide a statutory framework where those claims could proceed if there is specific notice given of an imminent and explicit risk of harm of violent behavior. And in that case, in this case, that did not occur. And, you know, as Judge Piper indicated in his dissent, to hold that this statute only applies to third-party violence would essentially create two standards in Ohio for courts to address violence committed by mental health clients. It would, under the majority decision by the 12th District, which we think is flawed and incorrect, there would be an analysis under this statute with respect to violence towards third parties, but with respect to self-harm, it would presumably be either professional judgment rule or a malpractice type analysis, which gets into the known or should have known, and it gets away from having direct knowledge of a foreseeable, imminent, explicit risk of self-harm, which did not occur in this case.
Why is having a different standard of harm to others and harm to self, why is that problematic?
Well, it's problematic because, for example, as in the examples that we cited, you can think of any innumerable murder-suicide situations that could be applicable. For example, a person is receiving mental health services.
But when you have murder-suicide, you have harm to another and harm to yourself.
Right. So under that scenario, if an individual is receiving services, mental health services, from either a community-based provider or inpatient or otherwise, and there's no notice that that person is going to commit an act of murder to a specific person or self-harm, and that person, whether it's a mass school shooting or a domestic situation or any other, you know, innumerable situations, hurts or kills others and then hurts or kills oneself, absent, you know, under that scenario where there was not notice given to the provider that the patient was going to do this, the estates of the third parties would be barred. Yet the estate of the murderer slash suicide victim would be allowed to proceed under a common law malpractice theory. So you'd have two separate theories that would, or two separate paths that would apply to two sets of victims. And I think that's inconsistent. I think it's unfair. I think it's not what the legislature intended in enacting the statute. Yes, this statute came on the heels of a decision regarding third-party harm. It was Mr. Morgan, who had mental illness for years, while playing poker, shot and killed his parents, shot his sister, who was seriously injured. All three of those estates brought action against his former psychiatrist that hadn't seen him for like 9 months, and then other providers that were seeing him on a local basis.
Well, counsel, as you said, that, you know, this was provided for in the statute. You read the statute as, you know, obviously as what you explained. But if there is a problem about an inequity or some, you know, two different standards for harm to others and harm to self, or not harm, or not, there's not a standard for harm to self, the legislature can take care of that by explicitly, amending this statute. Can they not?
Of course, and I'm not arguing that this court should do any type of policymaking with respect to the statute, because we believe that the language is clear, the intent is clear, and that if it's constructed to avoid unreasonable results, that that is the result. I was just making a comment that that would be, I think the legislature intent in enacting this statute to apply to all violent behavior, in other words, civil liability to providers for violent behavior, was to create a uniform standard as opposed to a common law standard on the one side versus self-harm and a statutory standard on the other hand. And so I believe that was the policy reason of the legislature in enacting this. They very well could have put in the statute that it does not apply to self-harm, that a victim has to be a third party. And they did not do either. They didn't define victim. And the ordinary definition of a victim would include anyone who's harmed, whether self-directed or otherwise.
Counsel? If we were to read the statute 2305.51B as you want us to, what if someone just exhibited suicidal ideations and it was clear enough that maybe they might carry it out? Could your reading of the statute actually result in needing to warn the members of the family for? Just because the person has expressed that they might commit suicide? I mean, I'm looking in the terms of a murder-suicide situation.
Yeah, I mean, so the statute, again, I think is artfully drafted in that if it creates a duty and sets it codifies the duty that if you're on notice of potential harm to others or to yourself, you have to do something, right?
What if it's just suicidal ideation and a pretty credible one? Wouldn't there be the potential that they could extend it beyond themselves, that they could hurt someone else first and then kill themselves? And so wouldn't that actually be more onerous on the mental health institution to take the precaution to advise the people close at hand with that individual?
Yeah, the statute would suggest under that circumstance that you would have to either explore involuntary hospitalization under the statute, you'd either have to notify law enforcement, or you'd have to develop a treatment plan. Essentially, those are the three things that a provider is supposed to do when on notice. And in that scenario, certainly there'd be additional inquiry and questioning. You know, if there was involuntary hospitalization pursued, certainly there'd be intense questioning of anyone else that you're thinking about harming or otherwise. And yeah, I think a provider who is aware that a patient is perhaps suicidal commonly reaches out to family members to articulate that information. I don't think that breaks confidentiality, and I think there's an exception specifically for that. However, absent notice of a third party clearly identifiable victim other than oneself, I don't think there's technical responsibility to notify everyone in the circle that may know this person. Might that be prudent behavior? Might that commonly occur? I think it does whenever there's someone, you know, put on suicide watch or admitted to the hospital for that or put on precautions accordingly.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kirchner.
May it please the court. Conrad Kircher on behalf of Benita Stewart, the administrator of the estate of Justin Stewart. I suppose I should address Justice DeWine's question about the final appealable order. At the trial court level, the appellant did indicate that they wanted to appeal. The trial judge indicated that he would like that resolved. We could have challenged a final appealable order at the 12th District. We could have raised that. We decided that the better way, Chief Justice O'Connor mentioned, we were going to face this sooner or later, now or at the end of the case. We decided to go ahead through the 12th District. We thought that would be the quickest way to get it back to the trial court. We did not expect to be here. We are here. We realize that the court is not in the business of advisory opinions, but we ask that you do deem it as a final appealable order so that we can get some resolution and move on.
Do you really believe that parties can agree to create subject matter jurisdiction for this court?
No, Your Honor, I do not. I'm not suggesting that.
Do you believe we have subject matter jurisdiction?
I believe it's arguable that this is a final appealable order.
Why?
For some of the reasons that my opponent has stated, that there is immunity involved. I realize it's not governmental immunity under 2744, but
it has a specific provision.
It does, Your Honor. But this is a substantial right, and you know, frankly, I think it needs to be decided. But I realize that's not the jurisdiction issue.
Well, let me ask a different question, though, we're talking,
sure.
As long as we're talking. Mm-hmm. Are the terms patient and victim mutually exclusive?
In this context, they are.
Tell me how.
Okay. And I think we have to analyze. So in statutory construction, this court has to determine what the law is, not policy issues, what it should be. So we start with the language of the statute, and I'd like to give four examples of where those terms are mutually exclusive in the statute. And the first one is under the key provision, subsection B. And this is where it identifies that a mental health provider can be liable if given a communication of a threat. In describing that threat, it says of inflicting imminent and serious physical harm to or causing the death of one or more clearly identifiable potential victims. Two points about that. First of all, victims is plural. Patient is singular throughout the statute. There must be talking about difference. Second is, what does that sentence not say? Let me go back. Inflicting imminent and serious physical harm to or causing the death of himself or herself or one or more clearly identifiable potential victims. It does not say that. Self-harm was not contemplated by this statute.
I hear what you're saying, but before the word victims, it says one or more.
One or more.
So it could be one victim.
Okay. So let me deviate then and maybe answer your question this way. The appellant is relying on the Merriam-Webster definition of victim. Okay? And what they have under that, the definition from Merriam-Webster they're relying on is one that is injured, destroyed, or sacrificed under any various conditions. Granted, a self-harm person could qualify as a victim under that definition if you remove the context of Estates versus Morgan and the other language of this statute, but so can an animal. Now, that sounds absurd, but I'm going to read that definition again and ask the court to determine whether an animal could qualify as a victim. One that is injured, destroyed, or sacrificed under any various conditions. It doesn't say person or human being who. It says one that. Now, am I suggesting that this statute applies to animals? No. Because that's not the context. But I'm showing the extension of the appellant's argument. Now, if I may, Your Honor, I'll go back to the three other examples I want to give about the statute. The next one is under A1F, which is the definition of knowledgeable person. And it has almost identical language to what we just talked about, inflicting imminent and serious physical harm to or causing the death of a clearly identifiable potential victim or victims. Now, here they use the singular or plural. But again, in that context, it has to be someone other than the patient, because the word patient is always used and it's always in the singular in the statute. Again, it doesn't say himself or herself. Third example is under B4, and this addresses one of the actions that a mental health provider can take to enjoy immunity once they receive this communication of a threat. And so one thing they can do is communicate to each potential victim or a potential victim's parent or guardian if the potential victim is a minor or has been adjudicated incompetent. Two points about that. Number one, I don't think the legislature would go into that much detail if the victim were the patient. They're talking about a victim who may be a minor or an incompetent person. And the second thing is, you don't need to communicate to the victims, to the potential victim, if the victim is the patient. Let me put that differently. You don't need to communicate to the victim this threat, because the victim, if it's the patient, already knows the threat and has already communicated it. So that doesn't make any sense. Final example is under C3. And this is kind of an exemption. The mental health professional does not need to take action under certain circumstances. And it says, if that action would increase the danger to a potential victim or increase the danger to the mental health client or patient, different people. There's a differentiation between those terms. And, you know, so that's what I think is the safest ground, looking at what the statute actually says or does not say. Now we examine the context of where this statute came from. And it was explicitly enacted to in response to a specific disagreement with one particular Supreme Court decision, Estates of Morgan. So that's the context. And in Estates of Morgan, the legislature determined that this court went too far in imposing a duty on a psychotherapist to control the violent conduct of a patient. And my opponent has already explained some of the background of that, of Matt Morgan, who had been an outpatient. He then murdered his family one evening, and this court determined that there could be liability for failing to control him.
Counsel, the distinction is Matt didn't kill himself.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So they created a statute to deal with, you know, liability, you know, for the mental health provider to someone who's not a victim in any sense of the word here. Correct?
I don't follow that, Your Honor.
Well, Matt Morgan's not a victim. He didn't kill himself. Under the statute, he's not a victim. And if you agree with the appellant here, so it's, I guess, the creation of the statute is one thing, but comparing this case that we have to the Morgan case, there is no comparison.
I agree with that because this statute and Morgan deal with liability to third-party victims, not to the self-harm of the patient. That's where, and this case before the court right now deals with a self-harm case. So you're right, Your Honor, that I agree that this statute does not apply to this case. So in enacting the statute, the legislature vacated the second, third, and fourth syllabi paragraphs of, or syllabus paragraphs of that case. The fourth one, I think, is the most important because it says, and this is what was what the legislature had trouble with, when a psychotherapist knows or should know that his or her outpatient represents a substantial risk of harm to others, the therapist is under a duty to exercise his or her best professional judgment to prevent such harm from occurring. So it doesn't say to himself or herself or others. It just says to others. And then when it refers to such harm, it's referring back to the harm caused to others. That was the context of this statute, no more than that. One other thing I want to mention about these Merriam-Webster definitions that the appellant is relying on, they're also relying on the definition of violence, and the dissent in the Court of Appeals did also. And it said, well, a suicide can be violent. Granted, it can be, and the suicide in this case was violent, self-harm. But it doesn't always have to be. It could be an injection. It could be drinking oneself to death. It could be pills. If you were to do that to a third person, inject a third person, perhaps that's violent. But injecting oneself or drinking oneself to death is suicide, but is not necessarily violent. So I don't think that applies either. Those are all the points I would like to make. Unless there are any other questions from the court, I will take my seat and ask that the court affirm.
I have one further question over here.
Yes.
Solutions had a contract with the jail, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So should there be any differentiation between situations when a mental health provider has a blanket contract with a facility or whether they're serving clients individually in a private setting? And maybe the answer is no. I don't know.
I haven't contemplated that, and I hesitate to give an answer that I haven't thought out on that. That's not this. I don't think this statute applies in either case. But I'm sorry, I'm falling short on that, Your Honor.
The reason I bring it up is some of the amici were essentially positing ahead of what the ramifications could be to people in jail if we reversed.
Well, and I think they make one very powerful point, and that is that if there is no accountability, then the quality of mental health services in a facility like this is really going to deteriorate. I think that's a very great point by the amici. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. I thought I reserved 2 minutes. Just very briefly, in the state of Morgan's case, Matt Morgan actually did file a lawsuit. It wasn't on purposes, didn't go on appeal. I don't think he was physically injured, but he sued his providers for not rendering proper care to him. And I would submit that even if he had committed suicide in that case, the same statute that was ultimately enacted on the heels of that decision would have been the same. Because the purpose of the statute was with respect to violent behavior, not the recipient of the violent behavior. In terms of counsel indicated syllabus 4 of Estates of Morgan, but paragraph 3 says the relationship between the psychotherapist and the patient in the outpatient setting constitutes a special relation justifying the imposition of a duty upon the psychotherapist to protect against and or control the patient's violent propensities, period. Doesn't say others, doesn't say third parties. And that was one of the paragraphs that statute was designed to supersede. And there was mention made in the briefing that the statute did not supersede or wasn't intended to supersede paragraph 1 of the syllabus. And that's simply because paragraph 1 had nothing to do with mental health providers or patients. It was simply a recognition of the restatement of towards section 315 that, generally speaking, there's not a duty of any of us to control the conduct of third parties absent a special relationship. And the restatement gives examples of parent-child and master-servant and otherwise where someone takes control of someone else.
But you pointed out this was an outpatient setting. This is in an institutional setting in a jail. And I guess I'm saying, does that make a difference?
I don't think it does. I mean, Littleton initially dealt with essentially the duties following discharge from the hospital, and it focused on really the continued duties after inpatient, and then Estates of Morgan dealt with the outpatient setting. The statute doesn't differentiate between inpatient and outpatient. It's just mental health provider providing services to a mental health patient in any setting. And contractually in this case, if you want me to respond to the question you asked Mr. Kircher about what does it matter if there's a contract in place institutionally or not, I don't believe that matters. What the statute is designed to do is to provide some level of protection to mental health providers with respect to unforeseeable acts of violence, self-directed or otherwise. If the act of violence is foreseeable, there's a pathway to pursue a claim, regardless of who the victim is, either the patient himself or some third party.
Thank you.
We request that the 12th District be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.